Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, investing in local communities, economies, and a sustainable future. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated. Member SIPC. Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on iTunes, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg. We have a special guest in London, David.
Yes, Willem Boudert, the global chief economist at Citigroup, joins us from there. We miss having him here in our Bloomberg 1130 studios in New York, but great to have you with us from London. There is such symbolism to this moment when we see this letter being delivered to Donald Tusk, the EU Council president. What notionally changes as a result of this? And indeed, we have the symbolism. What's going to change with regard to the economy when this letter is delivered?
The clock starts ticking. Unless a miracle happens, Britain will be out of the EU in 2 years' time. This will concentrate the mind. We'll see the opening bid of the British government in that letter, and we'll get, I think also quite publicly, I would expect, the initial response of the European Council and the Commission, and indeed the European Parliament, which of course has to approve the whole deal. It really is it's a defining moment. I think those who hoped it wouldn't happen or felt that it could happen smoothly and without any material pain for the British economy will, I think, have their nose rubbed in the unpalatable facts as the weeks become months.
How worried are you here about the element of surprise? Indeed, we've heard quite a bit from Prime Minister Theresa May since this referendum. She stuck to the timetable she set out several months ago. Are you worried about a sort of surprise factor here in light of what we've seen in the UK economy thus far?
No. I think the positions are pretty clear. The British government has, waded back from its Conservative Party conference rhetoric and its embrace of the hard Brexit. It's clearly trying to find a way of getting some interim agreement which will have significant continuity for British business. So I think there's at this point little element of surprise. If we don't get an early agreement on the existing EU citizens in the UK and UK citizens in the EU on Northern Ireland and on the budget, that would be a surprise.
If we do this in 2 years, Professor Boudert, it will be a century, 100 years from the Paris Peace Conference associated with Versailles. I don't see a David Lloyd George, a Vittorio Orlando, a George Clemenceau or a Woodrow Wilson in sight. How do negotiations actually occur? I mean, how do you visualize negotiations? Are they done at a, La Quinta Hotel in Brussels? Or, I mean, what's going to be at the table? Where's the table going to be?
There's no precedent for
exactly.
For all I know, they will be sitting in the Roi d'Espagne on the Grand Place in Brussels. But I think they'll probably meet in commission premises or something like that. I doubt whether they would insist on neutral territory, sort of a demilitarized zone in the middle of Brussels. I think the logistics are actually not going to be that important. It's really the mandates that the negotiators will start with. And it will be especially interesting to see what the Commission and the Council come up with in terms of guidelines and sort of opening positions. That's the great uncertainty to me at this point.
Willem, what are the soft data telling us now about the UK economy? How is sentiment in the United Kingdom about the Brexit, indeed, what may follow after?
Sentiment has been remarkably robust until quite recently. There is some indication now that, especially among SMEs, and very recently also among major corporations, Japanese among them, making capital expenditure and FDI decisions, that they are looking at ways of reducing their exposure to Britain. But until now, consumer sentiment has been remarkably robust, and as has corporate sentiment. The only place where we've seen concern expressed and the anticipation of pain has been the exchange rate. Mm. And ironically, that has, of course, helped the rest of the economy.
No, there's no question about that. Let's come back with Willem Bouter in our London studios on this most historic day. I'll tell you, David, it was something to see the Prime Minister migrate by Jaguar from 10 Downing Street over to Parliament. I mean, there's that, you know, even for us from a distance, it's happening.
Yeah, and to see the footage that our colleague Matt Miller tweeted out as well of the ambassador to the EU arriving in a Jaguar as well with that letter in a briefcase, soon to be delivered to the president of the EU Council.
Yeah. I mean, I would have gone in a Range Rover, Land Rover Defender.
Marked the moment, you know, with a larger vehicle.
With the Hunter boots, looking very queen-like, like out in the tundra. David Gurin, Tom Keene in New York, in our London studios, Willem Bouter of Citigroup. Professor Bouter, help me here with your great call on slower economic growth, on a global slowdown. What's it going to take for you to move your vector? I don't mean to get the gloom right, but how do you get more optimistic? What do you need to observe in the global economy that would get you more optimistic about economic growth?
Well, from a sustained longer run perspective, we would need structure reforms, more capital expenditure, broadly defined, including infrastructure, human capital, and I think an elimination of trade barriers and barriers to of mobility of labor and capital. So all these things be moving in the opposite direction. So that's unlikely to happen. From a short-run cyclical perspective, what we anything that looks like a fiscal stimulus, implemented or anticipated, will boost the level of activity. That's happened in the U.S. to a certain extent, although with growing doubt about the ability of the Trump administration to deliver a meaningful fiscal stimulus. I think that particular source of animal spirits may be wearing thin. Likewise, we have less fiscal restraint in the euro area, partly as a result of a number of key elections taking place. All that, I think, boosts economic activity in a cyclical manner. That's not sustainable, of course, but it's nice when it lasts.
You mentioned that growing doubt, and I wonder sort of what's changed about your outlook here over the last week in light of what we saw in Washington on Friday, as we saw that healthcare bill being pulled off the Congress's floor.
Yeah, it was just the ability to deliver. Right. Really has to look at Washington as not having the Republicans in charge of the White House and both houses of Congress, but being in charge of both houses of Congress with an independent in the White House, and it's become clear that the ability of the president and the Congress to deliver key reforms is very questionable. And even within the Republicans in the House and the Senate, there are these very sharp divisions now that have undermined Speaker Ryan's position, his credibility. The Freedom Caucus and other Tea Partiers are, I think, orthogonal both to Ryan and to Trump. So it just looks like a bit of a disorganized mess.
Help us with this strange word, eurosclerosis. I mentioned it the other day and got a nasty note from someone saying, oh, you're so gloomy. The nominal GDP that Citigroup looks for the United States of America, is it unique, separate, and discrete, or is it just plain old simple eurosclerosis?
You mean the low growth in the United States?
Yes.
Partly, of course, a reflection of aging, of demographics. But on top of that, I think there is 40 years of progressive overregulation, increasingly distortionary, and distributionally undesirable taxation, a legal system that has made lawsuits so easy that a whole range of human activity, including healthcare, are slowed down and burdened with enormous costs. So the U.S. is indeed a country that is in deep-seated supply-side trouble and needs both widespread deregulation and active tax reforms and selective boosts in public expenditure on health, education, well, and infrastructure. So the country really has all its work cut out for us, for itself.
Willem Bouter, thank you so much with Citigroup. Greatly appreciate, particularly David and I, again, thank you for your work the day of the Netherlands election. That was really a special moment. Brought to you by Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, dedicated to bringing our clients insights and solutions to meet the challenges of a transforming world. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated, member SIPC. On this historic day for the United Kingdom, Daniel Yergin, Professor Yergin, Dr. Yergin, rather, The Commanding Heights is the iconic book on the ascent of the United Kingdom. This is not a United Kingdom Clement Attlee would know at the end of World War II. The Prime Minister gave a rousing speech today. What is the perspective you can give on how these negotiations will go for Prime Minister May, given the sprawl from 1952, all of the trade discussions with the EU, the Union? What is the perspective today forward?
I think that the good morning, Tom. I think that the phony war that's gone on for the last 10 months about Brexit, of course, it's now the real war has begun, and I think it's going to be a big and tough struggle. No one really knows how it's going to go. The EU is proposing a $60 billion bill to Britain. And I think it's what's at stake, of course, is not only for Britain, but is for the EU, which is dealing with the stresses that come from the common, having a common currency that isn't backed up by common institutions, the euro, and compounded by the open borders. So, I mean, for the EU as much as Britain, this negotiation is so essential because it's also about the future of the EU.
Where is the commanding heights of Europe? Is it at Chancellor Merkel's desk?
Well, at this point, it has been Germany has been really the political and economic engine that has kept the whole thing together. Her position, thought to have been weakened by the influx of a million migrants, but the Germans did well in the most recent elections, her party. So she is the, you know, she is the kind of personification of Europe right now, particularly with this potential disarray in France.
There was a remarkable moment in the speech, I thought, when Prime Minister Theresa May said, perhaps more than ever, the world needs the democratic liberal values of Europe. And you heard the jeering and the laughter from the backbenchers in Parliament. What did you make of that line? Indeed, what did you make of the overtures that the Prime Minister made to the greater European community in the speech today?
Well, I think she's, you know, she has to play a very complex hand here in terms of what part of Europe or Europe connections will remain. And so, you know, that's an olive branch, in a way, to the Europeans. You know, I'm sure that line was very carefully crafted as they begin these really tough negotiations for which there's no precedent.
What's the best case scenario here for a deal? I imagine the best case is one that's concluded or agreed upon within this two-year period. But what are you looking for when you think of what a good deal for the UK and the EU might be?
Well, for the UK, I think it would be a way to continue to be active in a almost in a free trade-like way with the EU, sort of going back to what the European Community was, a trading group, and to maintain the financial position of London as a basis for Europe. I think for the EU, the stakes really are to make sure that this is not the first of many and that this doesn't feed populism. And I'll tell you, the French elections will be so critical to what happens next.
On oil, and of course everybody wants to know what Daniel Yergin thinks of oil. Let's bring the two together. Oil in Scotland. The North Sea isn't the North Sea of the commanding heights, is it?
No, it's quite different. You know, when they had that Scottish referendum, which was very close, a few years ago, it was when oil was still $100 a barrel. I've often wondered how that vote would have gone when oil was $40 or $50 a barrel, because part of Scottish nationalism has always been, well, it's our oil and we'll get the oil. And but in a lower price range, Scotland, you know, it doesn't have that fiscal advantage that comes from higher priced oil. So, it's a question of the Scottish Parliament may vote that they want a referendum, but that doesn't mean that there'll necessarily be a referendum.
How important?
So for Theresa May, this is really a two-front war. One is with Brussels, and the other is with Edinburgh.
How important are these EIA data we'll get today at 3:30 Wall Street time?
Oh, listen to you putting Jürgen on the spot. He'll never come on the show again.
And fold it into the conversation that was so dominant. The EIA data.
Oh, right.
The EIA data. And folded into the conversation you had in Houston a couple of weeks back at your CERA conference, what we heard from the Saudi oil minister there.
Well, it was very interesting because, of course, when we began the conference, the oil price was up 75% from what it had been when we held CERA week the year earlier. By the end of the week, the oil price was down 10%, not connected to the conference, but
yeah,
I think
sure.
to because we had the Saudi minister, the Russian minister, the Secretary General of OPEC, the head of IEA there. And, you know, the message was that this OPEC, non-OPEC agreement is really going to hold. But as you point to, inventories, you know, that they said the key metric that they'll be looking at is inventories, and inventories remain high. I think that what was already clear in Houston is that the next key date is May 25th when OPEC meets. And I think coming out of this meeting this weekend,
right,
wait, they're signaling that they really, if they don't extend their six-month agreement, 6 months goes by quickly, that would put new pressure on the oil price. Particularly, I should say, with the amount that U.S. producers have been able to hedge their production forward.
Dr. Yergin, honored to have you on with us for this historic day of United Kingdom. Folks, I'll put out on Twitter, Jürgen's The Commanding Heights. Can't say enough about it. We are on the edge of April, and April in any and all cases means the meetings of the International Monetary Fund. We'll, of course, give you complete coverage of that. We begin today with the publication of Fiscal Politics, and are honored to bring you Vito Gaspar with the International Monetary Fund. Dr. Gaspar, good morning.
Good morning, Tom.
Within your wonderful document and thoughtful 400 plus pages, could you please tell me what you learned about austerity? You know, I look at the history being made by Prime Minister May today. I look at the challenges of Europe, and that word from 3 or 4 years ago was austerity. How does austerity fold into our political fiscal or our fiscal politics?
So, Tom, political economy aspects, the link between politics and economics, was a tradition in economics up to the beginning of the 20th century. That tradition has been a little bit lost recently, and about 2 years ago, We decided at the Fiscal Affairs Department of the International Monetary Fund that looking at the relation between politics and economics in general, and especially the relation between politics and fiscal policy, was key. And so we launched this project that is now come to the presentation of this book that includes three parts and 19 chapters on a very wide variety of topics on fiscal policy and politics. Unfortunately, we don't have a special focus on austerity, but we do have quite a lot on how one should think about the political conditions that allow governments to follow sound, counter-cyclical fiscal policies, which is a key priority today. I hope, Tom, that given that we launched this program, this project 2 years ago,
right,
you will concede to us that we got our timing more or less right. No, Tom?
One of the chapters of the 19 that stood out to me is one that you authored here.
Yes.
On lessons that the European Union can learn from early American history. Give us the precis of that. What lessons are there to be learned from what happened in this country when it comes to supranational fiscal policy?
Oh, that experience is absolutely fascinating. So if you go to the beginning of the U.S. administration with Alexander Hamilton, so in 1789, Hamilton already benefited from the U.S. Constitution. One of the innovations from the U.S. Constitution was that the federal government was given the power to tax. Since that power was no longer disputed, the federal government had the ability to generate the revenues necessary to service and repay the very large debts that had been accumulated during the War of Independence. And Alexander Hamilton was extremely systematic in building the new U.S. federal administration that, of course, did not exist before. He built up the U.S. tax capacity at the federal level, completely from scratch. And one of the aspects that I develop more in this paper is that he set up the conditions that allow U.S. Treasury bonds to become the ultimate safe asset in the U.S. and a cornerstone of the U.S. financial system. And that is the part which I believe is more relevant for European integration
right
today.
We have breaking news, sir, so we're going to have to leave it short. But Vítor Gaspar, congratulations on this work from the International Monetary Fund. Fiscal politics really beginning to kick off the view of international economics that focuses on the World Bank and IMF meetings here in the end of April. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on iTunes, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm out on Twitter at Tom Keene. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio. Brought to you by Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, dedicated to bringing our clients insights and solutions to meet the challenges of a transforming world. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated, member, SIPC.